This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Andy McNab, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you.
Andy is a best-selling British novelist and former British Army infantry soldier. He was the British Army's most highly decorated soldier when he left the SAS. He has since written many works of fiction and non-fiction, from military history to thrillers and books for children, including Bravo 2-0 and the best-selling Nick Stone and Tom Buckingham series. His latest children's book, co-written with Jess French, is called My Mum is a Spy and is a funny, action-packed adventure. Wow. I mean, I feel that we met years and years ago when you came to Australia. How many times have you been to Australia?
Oh, maybe 10, 12 times.
Oh, just a over lot here. Of times.
I've got friends in Adelaide as well. So we go to Adelaide and, you know, we've done all the tourist sort of trips, you know, from Queensland going all the way down on the East Coast on the Cook Highway, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's good.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you love it here, obviously, and you know it well. But I think my experience was where you had your first book published, or maybe your second book, but I remember it to be Bravo 2-0. Or maybe I remember, because I was a bookseller back then, working on the shop floor. I've got to tell you, I sold hundreds of copies, hundreds and hundreds.
Good. That's what we like to hear.
That's right. That's what every author wants to hear, right?
Yeah,
but it was such an unusual thing at the time, and I don't know if anyone's done it since, but talk to me about your life growing up. I mean, it's extraordinary, and I don't think I knew until doing the research that you were left at the hospital as a baby. I don't know if I knew that at the time. So start there.
Yeah, well, I was left at a South London hospital as a couple of day old baby, and it was an ambulance crew that found us at the entrance of the A&E, the accident and emergency area. So basically, I was in a home until I was about five, I think it was, and then got adopted by the cleaner who used to come in and clean in the home. And really bizarre, in them days, she used to take kids home at the weekend and say, oh, I'll have him, I'll take him home for the weekend. You know, imagine that happening now. So I was adopted when I was five. I had an elder brother in the house as well, who was also adopted from the same home by the same woman. We weren't natural, biological brothers. So that felt, do you know what, it felt all right. You know, I thought, that's what I thought. What happened? I thought, well, you know, you're in a home, and then someone sort of picks you up and takes you home.
Like that happens to all of us.
Yeah, exactly. That's what goes on. So I thought it was great, and I even liked it in the home. And then I was adopted into working class family as such, you know, and the dad was doing all sorts, you know, he was window cleaner, then he was a milkman, and then he was working in plastic molding. I had no idea what that was, but he was a plastic molder for some years, you know, all that sort of stuff. My mum used to, clean, and she used to work in a laundromat, that sort of stuff. And we lived on a council estate, you know, social sort of housing. And basically, I didn't bother with school because I always thought everything's going to be all right anyway, so don't need to worry about school. And landed up at 16 in juvenile detention. And at that stage in the UK, we had what was called the Borstal system, and it was all about something called the short, sharp shock. The idea was to, the government of the day decided what they're going to do. They're going to scare these sort of 16 to 15 or 18-year-old kids.
Were you causing trouble on the estate? Is that what was happening?
Well, basically, I got arrested, and we at that time, I think we were called juvenile delinquents at that time, and the government was going to get grips of all the juvenile delinquents. So this system was imposed, and so I went into a ball stall, And I don't know, it was in North London, and literally, you know, I'd never been north of the River Thames. I could have been in Scotland for all I knew. Yeah. All I knew was my Asna estate, you know, and that was it. And at that time, it was a lot of organisations that were lobbying government to say, look, the Borsal system doesn't work. There's no rehabilitation, education, all that sort of stuff. So there, different groups were allowed to go into the Borsals. And one of them was the army, all about social mobility, you know, try and get these kids to do something else. And that's when I thought, well, all right, I'll join the army, because the deal was, if you signed on and they accepted you, you would leave the Borsal, and that was it. So great. So you sent
a ticket out.
Yeah. So I thought, well, I'll do 3 years and then I'm out, which was the minimum time you could serve at that time. And then because I was only 16, I went into what was called an infantry junior leaders battalion, where you served a year there. And what I didn't realize is, because all the training is a year long as opposed to 6 months long, you signed off for 6 years. So I thought, right, the army's ripping me off, because I've had to sign off for 6 years as a 16-year-old. But it, you know, it got me out of Borstal.
Did you like it initially? Did you?
No, I hate it.
No. Okay.
Well, it was worse than Borstal. I thought, because all they got, you know, you had the instructions what to do. So I got my hair cut, and, you know, turned up, they took another layer off. So you're there with this number one sort of crew cut. And I was 16, nearly 17 by then. And every day you had to shave. I didn't have to shave till I was about 18 or 19, properly anyway. You know, I had acne.
Oh.
So I'm shaving off there with the spots every morning.
Don't.
This army business. I know. This army business, you know, and it's, you know, all the marching and all that sort of stuff. Actually, it took about 3 months, what they called the bedding in period anyway, to start getting the reasons why all that sort of stuff went on. And then once you get your head around it, it was all right. And what I couldn't understand was, which I do now, but I didn't at the time, I couldn't understand why kids were, because that's what we were 16. Mm. I couldn't understand why they were all like homesick. And, you know, the people who, there was the first couple of months you could sort of leave early. And I couldn't understand why they were all homesick. And, you know what I mean? Because the reason was because they had quite nice, stable family lives. But, you know, so.
What was your relationship with your parents then at that stage, your adoptive parents?
Yeah, it was all right. It's, you know, they were, for me, it was like a waiting room. They were, you know, I wasn't sort of, you know, physically, sexually abused, all these sort of stories that, yeah, everything was all right, but probably left to have too much freedom. Yes. You know, because my dad used to work at nights. My mum used to be out in the morning. So we call them sort of latchkey kids now, yes. You know, where you've got your key and your. And I thought it was great, but that was the problem. It was a bit too much freedom, I think, to do, you know, what I wanted to do. But, yeah, you know, my dad thought I was an idiot joining the army. He was at that stage, he was a proud deserter from the Army Catering Corps during National Service.
Yeah.
Well, he wanted to join the Navy when he was conscripted during the National Service here in the UK. And they sent him to the army to learn how to fry eggs. So he said, oh, I don't like that. So he left. And so all the time I was in the army. So I'd done 18 years in total. There was an amnesty for National Service guys. It was an administration thing, you know, sign a bit of paper. And you actually get a day's pay. And I used to say, well, come down, you know, come down to where I am. You know, you do the paperwork and, you know, you get a day's pay. And he still wouldn't, because he was so proud that they never caught him.
Yes, well.
And actually, on the good side of it, he was a better cook than my mum.
Mm-hmm.
All that time.
Well, it's good training, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So talk to me about your career in the army.
So I joined this infantry junior leaders battalion at 16. And for me, what happened, that's when my education started, because up until then, I didn't realise the reason why I was in infantry and not flying helicopters like the recruiting film we saw at Borstal was that, well, in fact, all of us there had the numeracy and literacy sort of rate of a 9 to an 11-year-old, which is in education parlance now, it's called Key Stage 2, of, you know, between 9 and 11. And my life all changed, not only in the military, but sort of education-wise anyway, because I didn't realise, you know, I thought the army's ripped me off again, sending me back to school, an army education corps. Mm. And the guy there was brilliant. He said, look, the only reason you lot can't read and write is because you don't. So today, all changes, and this is how we do. So my education actually started there, which was great, you know, realizing that that actually I do need one.
Guy who was illiterate at nine or had the ability of a nine-year-old at 16 goes on to be an author, to be a writer.
Yeah, I know. It's mad, isn't it?
It just shows what you can do.
Well, exactly. And it's still now I go into our underperforming schools. You know, they're in a league table. So they go into underperforming schools. I go into prisons and the workplace as well, in the factories and all that, and tell this sort of story and basically saying, lads, if I can do it, you can. Mm. You know, it's not as if that's what's going to happen. But actually it gives you, you know, at least you've got a bit of a fighting chance.
Yeah. So you're in the education division. Tell me what happens from there. You learn to read and write.
Well, education started from there. And like what I know now, it's infectious. Once you start, that's it. You've cracked it. It's like a drug.
Mm.
So my education carried on because within the military, you can be the best soldier in the world, but if you haven't got certain academic qualifications, you're not getting promoted, you know. So that was the reason why it was this big education setup. And in fact, the military education in the UK is the biggest adult education setup.
Oh, wow.
In Europe. It's amazing because you've got to take like people like me, I suppose, and, you know, sort of educate them. So I'd served a year there, and then I went into an infantry regiment called the Green Jackets, which is a light infantry regiment. And so for the first sort of 4 years, I was there for 8 years. And the war at the moment, at that time, was Northern Ireland. So we used to do these things called emergency tours. It's between 4 and 5 months, about 5 months maximum. So every year we used to do these emergency tours. And for an 18-year-old squaddy, as it was, because you couldn't go until you was 18, because a couple of years before that, there were so many sort of under-18s getting killed, you know, young soldiers getting killed. So the age for operations was changed for 18. You know, the first tour I went literally joined a battalion on my 8th birthday, and I actually thought it was all right. I, you know, because you don't spend any money. You know, you should buy a bit of toothpaste, a bit of soap, and that's about it. You got 50p extra a day then on that first tour, which was amazing, and soft toilet paper, all the luxuries in life. You know, because in the battalions you get that greaseproof stuff. I don't know what it's called, but anyway, that paper, crinkly paper stuff. And so you'd come back from this tour with over like £1,000. So I was an 18-year-old with £1,000.
Yeah.
The second-hand car dealers are all waiting for you, you know, when you come back in the garrison town. So we all used to buy old crappy cars and, you know, used to crash them or they get stolen and, you know, just chaos. Because you'd only be in the garrison again for maybe about 6 months, and then you'd go back to Northern Ireland. So I'd do the same again: save the money up, buy an old crappy car, crash it or whatever. Not worry, do it again. So after about a third tour, you know, I still had no money. I definitely had no car. So I thought I better switch off this army business. And so eventually, in the infantry, became a platoon sergeant in a rifle company. And that's when I thought about joining the Special Air Service, or what's similarly known as the regiment. They get these, you know, within the military, it's just called a regiment. And it's full of, like, you know, there's full of horror stories about the selection process and, you know, all this sort of stuff. But I thought, well, I'll give it a go.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And was it a rigorous selection process?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It's on average, there's about, it's a 6 month process. On average, there's about 200, maximum 220 on each selection, two selections a year. And between 8 and 12 people per selection, we'll get through the whole sort of wow. 6 months. Yeah, it is quite selective. And so it's, you know, people think it's all about sort of, you know, I don't know, toughness and all the sort of things. Yeah, there's loads of TV shows that you know, pretend to be like the selection process. But actually, as well as the if you like, the physical stamina, it's the aptitude to do that sort of work. And actually, the aptitude to learn quickly as well. Because, you know, I went as a sergeant from the infantry, and I sort of knew a bit, but didn't know anything what they wanted us to know, you know. So what was happening, you got to have the ability to take that information in as well. So which is just as part of the selection as anything else. And I passed.
Hang on, let's go back. Just so I passed. Just give me some examples. Can you give me examples of some of the things you had to do?
Yeah. Well, the first month is actually what's technically called selection, and the rest of it's called continuation. So the first month is just spent in the Black Mountains in Wales, which is to the west, in the west of the UK. So basically, what it is just navigating across the mountains, Bracken Beacons and the Black Mountains, with a berg and a backpack on and a weapon and map reading. And every day, you don't know the route and you don't know the weight of the burden you've got to carry. So it's between 15 kilometers and 64 kilometers. Last one is 64 kilometers. So what happens is that you get dropped off in a truck and say, right, where are you? And you show them on the map and they say, right, go to this grid reference, 8-figure grid reference, which is a 10 square meter sort of area. And they go, which way is that? And you point and they say, right, you better get on with it. So you don't know the cutoff time for the day's what we call TAB, tactical advance to battle. So you just got to keep moving as fast as you can and map read. And what it's designed to do is obviously to see if you've got stamina, but and also mental stamina, just keep on going every day. Because a lot of people who go, you know, I don't know, I think they're going to be James Bond or something. I don't know what goes on in their head. So what that does, that gets rid of a lot of people who, you know, haven't got enough commitment. Sometimes it's through injury, and there's people who will be injured that would have made good special air service soldiers, but there's no way of dealing with that. And so my selection, in fact, there was 220, and that got us down to 24. So there's 24 left for the next 5 months. There's lots of stuff you do. You learn demonitions and different all sorts of stuff, you know, the bases of what they want to show you, and to see if you can take that information in. And then the next big hurdle is the jungle phase. So you go into the jungle. I went to Brunei, and you go in for 31 days in a little 4-man patrol and learning the tactics, how, you know, special forces work within a jungle environment. But it's not only that, it's to see if you can, you know, work sort of unsupervised, in a team. Some people find sort of jungle quite claustrophobic, you know, they just haven't got the aptitude for that sort of life. And everything during the jungle phase is done with live ammunition. So there has been sort of deaths. People have been killed during the jungle phase. There's people who have been wounded during the jungle phases. And the argument is well, the training's got to be realistic, because otherwise it's not a good duty of care to the people who do get in a squadron, and they've got to do it for real. You know, it's pointless training for training purposes. So out of that jungle phase, there was 24 of us went in, and then 8 of us passed that.
Only 8.
And you go down the road. And then you move through. There's lots of other things that you've got to do. But the next final hurdle is called combat survival, and it's basically, it's two parts. There's one part where you learn, you know, all the sort of survival skills, you know, making tea out of barks of trees and catching rabbits and all, you know, surviving in the field. And the other part is called R2I, resistance to interrogation, where you learn different techniques from different people, and then you then go on the run, and there's an infantry company that's out to try and find you, and helicopters and dogs and all that sort of stuff. By design, you are caught anyway, and then you go through a system of interrogations, because all countries have got interrogators and interrogation centers. So it's the only part of the selection where the regiment training team can't pass or failure. It's the organizations, the interrogators that come in and we get taken to their facilities, and then we go through an interrogation system with them, and they're the ones who say if we passed or failed. And actually, fortunately, all eight of us got through that final sort of.
And is it this real interrogation? Like, is it?
Yeah.
The torture that they basically use.
Well, no, it's not. It's not torture. People do land up in hospital. I think that in some cases, it's the mental strain rather than the physical strain. So you're held in isolation. You're held in stress positions. You go through the interrogators because the interrogation organisations use it for them as training as well for their interrogators.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you and the way that you conduct yourself in an interrogation and what information you can get to see where you maybe are in their process, that sort of thing. So just as important of going through that interrogation, I think mine. And again, you lose all sense of time and distance. I thought I was in for maybe about 15 hours. It was 39 hours because you lose all that sense of time. But the important thing afterwards is that you have a big debrief with them as well. So they talk about what they thought of you. You talk about what you sort of gained from them because you're always blindfolded and all that sort of stuff. And then they pass you. And again, there's about another month of different training before you get what's called badge, where you become, you join your Sabre squadron. And what happens is, no matter what rank you are, you lose all your rank and you start again. So I was a sergeant and then I became a trooper, like a private soldier again within the Special Air Service. And then you have to sort of start again.
And how soon was it that you got your kind of real gig?
Well, within 2 days. The squadron, I joined B Squadron. And B Squadron were already out on an operation in Southeast Asia. So I got badged on a Tuesday. And flew out on a Thursday and met them sort of, about 3 or 4 days later. So they were already in the rainforest. So I turned up as a new boy, with the uniform smelling of Daz and, new boots, all that sort of stuff. They'd already been in for about, a month, with the big long beards and all that sort of stuff. So literally it was good actually. It was because like the whole squadron was there, because sometimes you might join a squadron and because different groups are different places all over the planet, you might not meet somebody who's part of the same squadron for about 2 years, because it was a squadron, there was a squadron turnaround on that operation at that stage. And so everyone was there. So for me, it was actually quite good that you got to see, all the people within the squadron. It's only about 60, it's not as if there's hundreds of them, but it was quite good.
So do they do jobs like go in and get hostages or, is it what we see in movies?
It's different. Yeah. Basically, what it is in all nations, it's the sort of same remit, really. It's maintaining the UK's interest overseas. So that's, if it is Australia, maintaining Australia's interest overseas, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so part of that is the counterterrorism wing, which is called CRW, Counter Revolutionary Warfare. And part of that is all the guys with all the black kit on and the hostage rescues and all that. And that's a tour that you do, a squadron does, and it takes it's a 9-month tour. So you do a 3-month build up, 9-month tour. And what that is a national and an international sort of commitment, a UK commitment. So all that stuff goes on, which are called like black ops in a way because you're wearing black. There's green ops, something like Iraq and Afghanistan would be green ops because you're wearing all the party gear, uniforms and body armor and all that. And then you've got things that the grey ops, and they are more of the civilian type things that you do. For instance, spent a year in Northern Ireland with the Special Air Service, which was called the Troop. So that's all sort of, long air, fast cars and all that sort of stuff, you think, and, weapons, pistols down your ankles and all that sort of stuff. And that would be grey ops because you're not in uniform, you're sort of trying to blend in.
So how long did you stay and why did you leave?
Yeah, I've done 10 years. So 18 years in total. Yeah, and I became the troop sergeant of an air assault troop. Gulf War happened, done the Gulf War, Bravo 2-0 experience happened. And then I served another 3 years after that on another one of these grey op There's two sort of wings, if you like. They would have got different names now, but it's counter-revolutionary warfare wing, which are, again, is the anti-terrorist stuff and the guys in all the black assault gear and all that. And their job is to stop stuff. And there's another group called Revolutionary Warfare Wing, and their job is to start stuff, you know, to start all that stuff up, you know, to get, which is a lot easier, actually.
Yeah.
And so I was serving just nearly 3 years after the Gulf War. I was in RWW, and again, you know, long air and cars and all that. And then one of the operations I was involved in was a thing called First Strike in Colombia, which was an anti-drugs Brit commitment to try and stop crack cocaine and cocaine coming into the UK. So that, which was an American-funded job, but that was being privatized by the Americans into a thing called Plan Colombia. So what they were doing, were getting all the special forces guys, the Brits and Americans, who had taken part in those operations, and the private military companies that were given the contracts, if you like, by the Americans, then would come to people like me and say, well, like, do you want to get out and go back for Plan Colombia? And so I had 4 years left, and that was the end of the time in the military anyway. That was it. I'll be out. That's the end of the contract. And so there's about 12 of us were getting out to go back to Colombia for Plan Colombia and work for one of the private military companies, which is a normal thing. You know, it happens sort of this big cycle, different things come up, and all the military companies are, you know, it's the same people anyway. You know them anyway because they come from the same environment. So it's going through that process to get out. And then I was invited to a general's house, which isn't an invite, you know, you will be there at like R7 sort of. And the proposal was put to me to write a book. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I was given a dress code for this informal sort of, you know, dinner. But there was an offer put to me and said, well, look, you're getting out, you know, you're going back working for one of the PMCs. Would you consider writing a book along with this general about the Gulf War? He'll talk about what's going on in Riyadh and the command center and Schwarzkopf and all that.
Why
sort of stuff.
Are you?
Well, because of the Bravo 2-0 experience. And then, so I'm thinking about it, thinking, well, you know, he's not doing it for my benefit.
Yeah.
So I found out about how this, you know, how this book business sort of works. So I went back to him about a week later and said, well, look, if I do it, I'm going to do it myself. I'm not going to do it with this general. And that's what happened. I got out. The book was published, Bravo 2-0 is published. I was in Colombia and because everybody thought it'd do all right, you know, but not as well as it did. So I get a phone call from the publishers in London. And I said, yeah, the book's massive. It's, you know, it's like number one here, there and everywhere and all that. Do you want to do another one? And I thought, well, what do you think? You know, get us a ticket and I'll be back to London tomorrow.
Yeah,
and that's how it all started.
Did you was it a pinch yourself moment when that book sold well and you, like, from where you came from to where you are now?
Yeah. It was interesting because, again, I knew nothing about publishing. I knew, not a clue. And this whole thing happened, you know, and it sort of just, it literally kicked off like another extreme. So it was sort of, it was interesting because you're sort of one extreme in a special air service and then sort of then move into another extreme within publishing, you know, because within about, I don't know, about 3 months of the book coming out. And then I was living in Los Angeles and I was there for about a year and a half working on films and, you know, all that sort of stuff, you know, and literally, you know, that really was a sort of pinch moment. So I'm living on Santa Monica near the beach. And I thought, okay. And I weren't even paying for it. And I weren't even paying for it.
This is better than the jungle, right?
I know. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, and so what made you start writing children's books?
Well, two reasons, really. There was going into schools, it really, really was clear, talking about, you know, the prospects of reading, it really, really was clear that, you know, once you get kids reading, it is infectious. It's it. You've cracked it. You know, absolutely. It's like a drug. You've cracked it. So, and it was certainly in the early days, we were looking at, certainly here in the UK, quite a lot of books were quite patronising. You know, these kids were watching sex and murder on soaps at 6:30 at night sort of thing, you know, much more switched on than a lot of the books sort of given credit for. So I thought, well, let's make something sort of more sort of realistic, you know, certainly for 12-year-olds upwards. And that's how it really all started. And then obviously, you know, my mum's a spy is the younger sort of group. So this is the, like, if you like, the new venture, getting in there, you know, to see if sort of seven upwards. It's just getting them to read. Once you get them to read, that's it. You've got them. You've got them.
Andy McNabb, it's been wonderful chatting with you. It's almost been like a wish come true. Thank you so much for your time. I really, really enjoyed it. I've followed your career and it's been an absolute privilege to chat with you.
No, thank you very much for having me. It's great.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.